Okay, Das Tunis, Rat Kuf Tzadik Hey. Machzor Azmanim. This is a new section where he's going to explain to us something about the cycle of time in Hanhog. In other words, we've been dealing with now with many themes up to this point of how the world is run, with all, some of its mysteries, things we can't understand, things that seem unjust, various elements of Hashgacha and Hoga. Now we're going to talk about time, how the time cycle work in the world, right? For example, this week, Tisha B'Av, what is the time energy that makes it such a difficult time, right? Why so many destructions have happened to us, and on Tisha B'Av itself, right, five different types of destruction, the decree that we would not go into the land, the destruction of the first temple, destruction of the second, Yerushalayim being plowed under, right? That is the five different tragedies, and that time is mesugal. The time lends itself to tragedy. So, what makes time? What is the nature of time? Why do the cycles of time in the world have the realities that they do? It's not just neutral opportunity for events. Each time brings with it a certain hanhaga, certain conduct in the world. But there's just as much a feature of the world as places. Some places, like Israel, different than other places. Yerushalayim, different again. The Beis HaMikdash, there's layers of concentric circles of Kedusha, right? 10 circles of Kedusha in the world. And the center of that is the Kodesh Kedoshim inside the Beis HaMikdash. From there, fan out all the concentric layers of place. And similarly, time in the world is layers of meaning, layers of the nature of time. Right, is not uniform. So let's try to see a little bit about what he says. Od yesh lach levayer lach, od yesh li levayer lach inyan hazman, ahilech behekef al kol ha'ishim b'shaveh. I have to explain to you now the nature of time that encompasses all, when he says ha'ishim b'shaveh, he means all things that exist in the world. I don't think he means people. Right, in Torah philosophical language, Ishim could mean all members, all the all aspects of the world, all the details in the world, equally. In other words, that seems to encompass all things equally in the world. We find that there are differences in the parts, in time itself. Time itself is a reality that has different qualities, different parts. Not because different things take place at different times, but because the times make different things possible. The conventional understanding is that time is neutral and events happen. And when the event happens, it gives a quality to the time. So for example, a year later you celebrate an anniversary of that time. Why do you celebrate that anniversary? Because this is the date on which the thing happened. But in Jewish thinking, it's exactly the opposite. In Jewish thinking, the time has a special nature, and that's why the thing happens. There's a reason you celebrate an anniversary, right? Let's say you got married on a certain date. Now, every year you want to remember that disaster, I mean, that that event. So now you want to celebrate that event. It's not, our understanding is not, for example, you celebrate a birthday, right? Without going into the whole halachic discussion about whether birthdays are meaningful in Torah or not. But let's say you celebrate a birthday. The common understanding is you happen to be born on a certain date. So every year when that date rolls around, you can acknowledge the fact that that's a special day, but we don't do it that way. We understand that the reason you were born on that date was because there was a special energy coming into the world. And therefore, if a person is deeply spiritual enough, they could celebrate the anniversary of an event before it happened. Make sense? If the time is special, then that time is always special. So strictly speaking, if you had enough insight into the conduct of the world, you could celebrate the time the year before it happened, or 10 years before, right? And we have examples of that in Torah. For example, when the angels visited Abraham, Avraham Avinu was visited by the angels, he served them matzah. He served them matzah because he was celebrating Pesach. Now Pesach hadn't happened for centuries because he was yet to found the Jewish people who would then become a nation 3 generations later that would go into Egypt and many generations later would come out. So Pesach, the eating of matzah on Pesach, the simple understanding is historical anniversary since we went out of Egypt and ate matzah at that time. Every year on that date, we revisit that time by eating matzah. But he was spiritual enough to know that that time of year means matzah and Pesach. He was able to celebrate Pesach before it happened. Is this clear? because he felt that the waves of energy in the world, the springtime, makes that sort of rejuvenation or that resurrection, whatever you want to call it, that is possible in the world. And therefore, he celebrated Pesach by giving matzah to the angels, right, in anticipation of what later would be an event that would take place at that time, because the time makes it possible. Actually, according to the Midrash, he served them a Pesach Seudah, Pesach meal, and a Purim Seudah at the same time, right? A Pesach Seudah and a Purim Seudah. Very interesting. Both of those things are happening at the same time, right? It says that when the angels came to Lot, when the angels came to Lot in Sodom, so he gave them matzah for Pesach and made them a Purim. The reason is the Torah uses the word that clues us in, Seudah is the Seudah of Purim, and the matzahs. So therefore, the Chazal here in that he was celebrating both Pesach and Purim. And of course, the meaning of that should be clear. The meaning of that is not so hard to understand. Pesach is the time of redemption of the Jewish people, and Purim is the ultimate redemption. Pesach is the first redemption, where the Jewish people get redeemed in a revealed fashion. And Purim is where it comes to fruition years later, where they get redeemed in a hidden fashion, where they decide of their own accord to see the divine hand, right? And therefore, the seed of all of that is happening where the angels are about to save Lot, in whom is the seed of what will become the Mashiach. What happens to Lot? He's saved from stone, spends the night in a cave with his own daughters, two nights, has an intimate relationship with his own daughters, and from that he's born the Mashiach, right? Ammon and Moav, and that whole story. And therefore, the Midrash says, Matzasi es David Avdi, Matzati et David Avdi, I found David my servant. So the Midrash says, Heichan Matzasi, where did I find him? Bistoim, I found him in Sodom. What is David, the Mashiach, right, doing in Stoim? It means he's living within the body of Lot, whose name means a curse. Lot, Layit in Hebrew means a curse, right? Lot, the opposite of Tal. Anyone who speaks Hebrew knows these things, right? Tal is the dew, which is bracha, and Lot, which is the opposite of, is a curse, right? Yeah, of course. Didn't teach you that at Hebrew school? Get your money back.
Space has got 10 concentric circles, does time also 10 concentric
circles? Yes, definitely. Yes, it does, absolutely. And we have to work them out. What are the times? You have Shabbat, which is the Makor HaBracha. You have Yom Kippur. It has many layers. In fact, there are 22, not only 10, there's actually 22 times in the world that are special. You know that if you count up all the Chagim during the year, it comes to 22 days. Make a cheshbon. Count up the day Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, 8 days of Pesach, count it up, you'll see you get 22 days. Those 22 days of the festivals are exactly the same 22 days that we're living through now. From the 17th of Tammuz to the 9th of Av, which is 3 weeks, including both ends, is 22 days. 3 weeks is 21 days, plus you're counting both ends. So we're living now through what should have been 22 days of the highest days of the festivals. It should have been midsummer, should have been the ultimate time, right, of rejoicing, reaching the climax on Tisha B'Av, which is supposed to be the ultimate festival. And the sadness of that time is because the sadness is because that all crashed. And therefore we now have, yes, hafachta mispadil macholi, now is the opposite. So the machol now is going back to being the sadness. And therefore we're living now through 22 days of destruction. And the real sadness is there should have been days of rejoicing. The saddest times in people's lives are the times that should have been the happiest. People's lives are sad, not when a tragedy occurs, but when a tragedy occurs on a day that should have been a day of rejoicing. You know, the suicide rates in the world are highest on days of festivals, like Xmas, for example. Xmas got the highest suicide rate in the non-Jewish world. Why? Because that's the time when it should have been close to your family and rejoicing. You know, the non-Jews only have one chag a year. No, they only have Xmas. That's all they have. I mean, we do it all the time, right? Every few weeks, we cooking and baking and sitting down and having a festival. I mean, it's like almost no time to work. In the non-Jewish world, they save up all year for Xmas, because the only time they have, right? The only festival they have is Xmas. So when that day rolls around and you're homeless or lonely, so that's very, and then the suicide rates are enormous then. That's because when there should have been joy and you feel the sadness, and that's what we're going through now in the summer. The 22 days leading up to Tisha B'Av are the time that were meant to be the time of rejoicing. The spies would have come back and given a good report, and they would have gone straight into Israel. It would have been all perfect. So now we are celebrating not just a lack, but the crushing of what should have been the best, right? And that is the That is the 22 days. So the times, these 22 days, each day, and of course Tisha B'Av should have been the greatest festival, whether it should have been Yom Kippur or whatever, it should have been the highest of the days. And now, of course, it will be again. That's why one of the reasons that a Tisha B'Av is also an aspect of rejoicing. Maybe we should talk about this a little bit. You know, the Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, there's an aspect of festival, even though we're sitting on the floor in mourning, there's an aspect of festival. First of all, it's called a moed. It's called a moed, right? It's like it says, moed lishbor bachurai, a festival in which my youth was smashed. But it's called a moed. Moed is a festival, right? All the festivals are called the moedim. Even Shabbat is called a moed. And therefore, for that reason, it's called a moed. So we don't say tachanun on Tisha B'Av. And yeah, it says some of the laws, the vestiges, overtones of a festival, because ultimately it will be a festival, and of course it should have been. This intense sadness of Tisha B'Av is that it's a destruction where there should have been a celebration. You know, the Arizal asks a very interesting question about Tisha B'Av. Arizal asks a very interesting question. He asks why on Tisha B'Av, in the afternoon, we lighten the suffering. You know, the law on Tisha B'Av is you don't sit on a chair, you sit on the floor. Right, Tisha B'Av, sit on the floor. But after midday, we lessen the mourning. We sit on chairs, we start saying psukim that have tanchumim in them, comfort. Instead of just celebrating the mourning, on the afternoon, we start looking at reconstruction. We start talking verses from the prophets that also talk about just as you were destroyed, you'll be rebuilt. A little element of hope. And we are no longer sitting on chairs. And therefore, the morning gets lighter in the afternoon, right? The Arizal says, he asks a question, a great Kabbalist, he asks a question, which really should be obvious to anyone who thinks about it, is that that is very paradoxical. Because the afternoon of Tisha B'Av is where things got worse, not better. The Beis HaMikdash was burnt in the afternoon, right? It says, Tzalalei Erev, when the shadows of night fell, in Yirmiyah talks about how the night started to fall, and then the real destruction took place. In the afternoon, they lit the Beis HaMikdash, and the night had burned. And it was burning all night, and it burnt the next day. Some people used to fast for 2 days. Because the 10th of Av, in one way, is even sadder than Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is where the destruction began. But the late afternoon, the Romans burnt the temple, and it burnt all night, and therefore, the real sadness should have been the next day. But the most intense sadness was the late afternoon of Tisha B'Av, because that's when the fire was lit, and then it became final, right? So the Kabbalist, and the Arizal is asking his question, if that is the worst time of day when the Beis HaMikdash actually burnt, how come we start lightening the morning then? We start getting up on chairs and we start talking about Tanchum, what is going on? And of course you have to understand, when a Kabbalist asks a question, it's always based on the deep energies. That means that the simple understanding is historical, right? The historical meaning is that the attack and the destruction took place in the morning, but the real final blow and the burning took place, and the destruction of the temple is called a burning. That it says Ba'esh Hitzata, you caused it to be destroyed in fire, Uba'esh Atid Livnota, and you will build it again in fire. Whatever that means. But it says Chomat Esh Saviv, there will be a wall of fire around Jerusalem. But the fire was lit in the afternoon. But being that is the great Arizal, the question has much more depth. And the question really is, of course, that the afternoon towards the evening is always the worst time of day. Kabbalistically, the afternoon going towards evening is the worst time of day. If you have any sensitivity, you will realize that what I'm saying is that the reason it burnt in the afternoon is because that's the worst time of day. It's not, that result doesn't mean that it happened to burn in the afternoon, right? And therefore we should have more morning. What he means is the afternoon is the time of destruction. The afternoon is the bad time of day. And therefore, like we said before, things happen because the time is Mesugal. And therefore, since the afternoon is a time of destruction, that's when the Beis HaMikdash was burning. And therefore, if you understand that, there's no way that you will lighten the morning at that time. It doesn't make any sense, right? That's his question. By the way, the afternoon and evening is always the worst time of day, because that is when you're moving towards darkness, right? Kabbalistically, from midnight is the best time of day. Midnight is where the light starts to dawn, although it gets darker before it gets light. But Kabbalistically, the best time of the day is from midnight on, right? Until midnight, very bad, very bad. Husband and wife should be together after midnight, ideally. It's a marital time, it's after midnight, right? The meaning is, there's many reasons given in halakha, but the deep meaning is because then that's a positive time. When husband and wife are together, especially if a soul will be created, from their togetherness. So the soul will be brought down. You want a neshama to be brought down at a time that is very high. The high time is from midnight on. The low time is before midnight, right? That's a time of potential disaster. You know that in the old Sephardi communities, and in Yerushalayim, you still find Sephardi communities that do this. The tradition was they would pray Arvit, the evening service, at sunset. Right? Exactly. Sun goes down, pray Arvit, and go straight to sleep. Straight to sleep. They would not even be awake in that time. From sunset to midnight is so bad that nothing good can come of that. You just want to be asleep. There's nothing else to do then. Right? You don't want to do anything at that time. So they would get to sleep right after sunset. At midnight they would wake up, do Tikkun Chatzot, which is the special prayer service at midnight. And then they would learn all night, right? Learn Torah all night. Just before dawn, go to mikveh. And then they would pray with the nets, with the rising sun. And then work all day. That's what they would do. That's what they would do. And they come home in late afternoon. They would do Maariv just at sunset and go to sleep. That was the cycle of time, right? I know people who do that. I know people who more or less do that. No. The Sephardim always maintained, a deeper sensitivity to these things. Sephardim were less damaged by the secular modern world in many ways. The Sephardi tradition always was much closer to Kabbalistic knowledge in an explicit way. Many examples of that. Was Yerushalmi custom also, Yerushalmi. Anyway, you Ashkenazi. Maybe you can marry us already. That'll help. Anyway, so that is what they used to do. So that's Arizal's question, right? His question is, why are we lightening the morning and the afternoon? Now the answer to that is very bizarre. You think the question's difficult, the answer's really bizarre. The answer that's given is his own answer, but one of the answers that's given about why there should be any cause for rejoicing or mitigation of the suffering on Tisha B'Av, right, is very bizarre. And the way it's put in Chazal is that instead of destroying us, Hashem vented his anger on stones and on wooden stones. That's what it says, right? Eitzim Vavonim. Instead of venting his anger on the Jewish people and wiping us out, he wiped out the building. That's what it says. Now, what does that mean? That means the Jewish people deserve to be destroyed. That was a destruction. But Hashem's kindness and the cause for rejoicing is that instead of pouring out his wrath on us, he poured out his wrath on a building. What is going on? I mean, the childish approach to that is, you know, he was angry. When you're angry, you need to break something. So, you know, instead of breaking, you know, you're angry with your wife, right? I mean, it would never happen. But imagine you have a fight with your wife. So a man of highly developed spiritual sensitivities, he doesn't break her jaw, kick her in the knee. He goes out and kicks the dog, right? That's what a spiritual person does. He kicks the dog. Or he goes and he puts his fist through the door, front door, or something sensible, right? That is the way to preserve your marriage, right? That's a much healthier... Yes. He broke the tablets. That's right. And that's the way to handle your marriage, especially if your wife is a black belt Aikido expert, then you don't want to start with it. Anyway, the point is that what does it mean? Hashem took out his anger on sticks, on stones, and what does that mean? What is going on, right? That is a question. What's meant by that? And why is that a cause for rejoicing? What does it mean? What's the rejoicing there? Another question you can ask is that the Gemara in Gittin says that a bill of divorce, a get, has 12 lines. You know this? I told you that? A get has 12 lines. Thursday night, Rav Moshe spoke about this. A get has 12 lines. And the reason a get has 12 lines, what is a get? It's a bill of separation, right? Husband gives it to the wife that he's separating the marriage. So the Gemara says, why does a get have 12 lines? So there's many reasons. One is because get is 12. Get is 12. But another reason is because if you look in the Sefer Torah, there are 4 lines between each book. When you write the Sefer Torah, so when you finish Genesis, Bereshis, before you start Shmos, you have to leave 4 lines blank. So between each book of the Torah, there are 4 lines blank. Now the lines that are blank are separations. They're separations between the books. So you add up the 12, the four lines between all the books of the Torah, you get 12 blank lines. And since those lines are lines of separation, so a get, which is a book of separation, should have 12 lines. The only problem is, what's the problem? Huh?
16.
That's right. If there are five books, there aren't 12 lines between them, right? Because if there's five books, there's four separations. That's what you mean, right? Between five books, you've got four separations. We're only counting three. So Tosfos, who talks about this, says we don't count the last one. Listen to this amazing thing. Did we talk about this? We don't count the last one. Because the four lines between Bamidbar and Dvarim, right? Bamidbar, Dibur, and Dvarim, which is Dibur, two aspects of Dibur Samah, those four lines do not count, says the Gemara. Because Dvarim is not really a new book, it's only repetition. That's what it says. Dvarim is Chazara. When Moshe Rab, what is the book of, we'll start this week, this is the week we start reading the book of Dvarim, right? What do we read the book of Dvarim? Moshe Rabbeinu Moses receives the Torah and then he gives it back. What is Dvarim? It's a repetition of what came before. First he goes over the history, he repeats all the journeyings and all the history of the Jewish people. Then he says again the mitzvot that they were given before. Which mitzvot? Interesting, not all of them. Says Rabbi Hirsch, the mitzvahs that are needed for going into Israel, because they're now preparing to go into the land of Israel, which is, right, which is the female aspect. This is the female aspect of Torah. What's the last incident? What's the last incident in the book of Bamidbar before we go into the land of Israel? The incident of the? But not Slavchad. The five women, females, five, demanding a share in Israel. Very amazing, right? Because women are always Midas HaMalchus. They are the aspect, and that's why Jewish women love Israel. Jewish women are the ones who love the land, right? You know what the Midrash says? An amazing thing. Shlach lecha anashim. You know this amazing thing? Hashem said, you want to send spies into the land of Israel? Shlach lecha anashim. Send men to go into the land of Israel, right? Shlach lecha, you send men. Had you asked me, I would send women. Isn't that amazing? The Midrash says, you want to get a good report of Israel? Send people who love it. You ask me, I say send women. Isn't that amazing? You send men, there's going to be problems. They're going to come back, they're going to say the people are giants, we can't fight them, it's all kind of stuff. Shlach lecha anashim. You ask me, I would say nashim. Isn't that amazing? Anyway, be that as it may. So the point is that the book of Devarim is a repetition of what comes before. Instead of the Torah being given from Hashem to Moshe, Moshe speaks the Torah back to Hashem. That's why, for example, the Ten Commandments are repeated. The Ten Commandments are repeated in Devarim, right? In the old Bible critics, the old Bible used to say, they used to say, you could see, anybody can see that the Bible was not written by God. Anybody can see that. Because the first four books have one style, and the fifth book has another style. It was written later by somebody else, right? Idiots. Observation is completely correct. Of course it has a different style. It was written by somebody else. The first four was written by God. The fifth was written by Moshe. Hashem agreeing to what he said. They always write in the observations. They're just wrong in the interpretation, right? So the fifth book is Moshe speaking. And therefore, says Tosfos, there's no separation between the four and the fifth, because the fifth is not a separate book. It's a repetition, right? It's chazara over the first five. And therefore, we don't call that... what does that mean? And maybe another question we could ask... Is there a chumash there? Anybody see a chumash? Thanks. Is that when we read the Haftarah, thank you very much, thank you. When we read the Haftarah of Destruction, so it ends on a very frightening note. Right, very frightening note. Yirmiyah ended the Haftarah of Destruction on a very scary note. Where is it? Not the Haftarah, I think in Eicha. Eicha ends on a very scary note. Yeah, Eicha ends like this. We are talking about the Megillah of Destruction, right? Which Yirmiyah wrote about the destruction of Yerushalayim. And he ends like this. Lama la netzach tishkachenu? Why will you forget us forever? Ta'azveinu l'orech yamim? You'll abandon us forever. Why do that? Hashiveinu Hashem Alecha v'nashuva. Return us to you and we will return to you. Chadesh Yomeinu kekedem. And renew our days. Ki im ma'os ma'astanu. You have despised us and found us disgusting. Katzafta aleinu ad mo'ad. You are very, very angry with us. End. Very, very dismal note, right, to end. So we don't do that. We add another line. When we read this, when we read Eicha, we add one more line. Hashiveinu Hashem Alecha v'nashuva. Return us, Hashem. Bring us back to you. And we'll return. Chadesh Yameinu kekedem. Renew our days like they used to be. But we add that line. He didn't add that. So the question is, Yirmiyah, Jeremiah, right? The function of the prophets. There are three functions to prophecy. Three functions to prophecy, right? What do the prophets come to add on to Torah? One is to show that Torah doesn't end. Torah doesn't end. There's a continuation of Torah through history, so the prophets are adding. The second is warnings. Warnings, right? The prophets are full of dire warnings. And the third is tanchumim, is some comfort. It'll be, in the end, you'll be redeemed, right? So Yirmiyah comes. Jeremiah is the one who really talks about the destruction, right? As you, in English, you have the expression of Jeremiah. That means somebody who's talking about doom and gloom and destruction. He comes, Yirmiyah is the one who comes primarily to talk about destruction. Yeshayah, Isaiah, comes to talk about redemption. That's the general principle, right? So Jeremiah, Yirmiyah is the one who talks about, he wrote Eicha, and he ends it on a note of absolute terror, right? That you've rejected us and you're extremely angry with us. We who live after him, we say we can end this on a good note. It's not, you mustn't be childish about this and think, well, we don't want to end on a bad note, so we'll say something good. You can't mess around. If he wrote the book this way, this is the way it's written. We're going to add another, you know, it's got to be a reason for this. The way to ask the question is, how come we are capable, we, in all our loneliness, we are capable of adding a line of hope when he couldn't? Why can we see further than he? That's the question, right? Why was he incapable of adding, he couldn't give us one line of hope at the end? He came to talk about terrible things, women cooking their children. That's what he talks about. Terrible. It doesn't get worse than this. It's an absolute, unspeakable disaster during the siege and the starvation and so forth, right? And people being slaughtered. He couldn't give us one line of hope at the end? He gives us a potential hope and then he says, no, you've disgusted with us and you're very angry. What is it? Couldn't do that. And then we come along and now we add a, what is this? The approach to all these questions is really that the approach is that the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, that is where Hashem resides in the world, right? The destruction of the temple means that Hashem is no longer with us in the world. That's the key. The mourning for the destruction of the temple, it's not like it was a national symbol, you know, that's where the Jewish people's, like the, you know, houses of parliament, or, you know, that's where people, symbol of the Jewish people's power. The concept of the Beis HaMikdash is a concept of a home. That's where you live together, husband and wife. That's the marriage, that's the togetherness, right? Hashem is with the Jewish people, the Shekhinah, which is residing in the Beis HaMikdash. And when it's destroyed, the problem is that there's no more soul there, there's no more Neshama. The mourning of Tisha B'Av is like mourning for the dead. When you mourn for a dead person, the mourning, all the laws of Tisha B'Av are the laws of mourning. And the laws of mourning are mourning for somebody who's no longer alive. The meaning of a person is no longer alive is that there's a body without a neshama inside. The mourning of Tisha B'Av is that there's a world without a neshama inside. Right? It's called halal. It's called halal in Hebrew means to be empty, a corpse. A corpse means a person, in English it's a dead body. In Hebrew it means a place that's empty, halal. Halal means a corpse, it means a place empty. Halal is space in modern Hebrew, right? A corpse means a body who's empty, empty of what it should have had, which is the neshama, right? Chilul, by the way, to make chilul Hashem. Chilul Hashem means to empty something of Hashem. A chilul means there should be kedusha here in the world, and you're banishing it, right? You're making it empty, right? So that is the concept of chilul, and the Beit HaMikdash being destroyed, that is a mourning for one who is no longer alive, and that is what it is. When Hashem is in the Beis HaMikdash, when he is present in history and he invests, he's living in the world in the place of meeting, which is called the Beis HaMikdash, that is called the Aron. That's called the Aron, right? Aron is the ark in which the Torah is. That's called the Aron. Inside the Beis HaMikdash, in the Kodesh Kodoshim, in the Holy of Holies, there's an Aron. And the Aron is where the Torah is, and the Shekhinah is resting on that place, right? That's called the Aron. By the way, the place of the Aron is the place where Yaakov Avinu slept. Yaakov, when he's traveling, he sleeps in the place that will later become the Beis HaMikdash, right? Amazing thing. And when he sleeps there, he suddenly wakes up and realizes this is the place of the Beis HaMikdash. And he says, Ma Nora HaMakom HaZeh. Nora is Aron backwards. Ma Nora HaMakom HaZeh. How amazing is this place? V'anochi lo yada, and I didn't know. Meaning Yaakov is, he is Aaron. What is Yaakov? Avram is Chesed, Yitzchak is Din, Yaakov is Torah. Yaakov is Torah, that's his Midah, that's what he represents. So he is the Aaron. Yaakov Avinu contains, he is the Aaron. And he's the one, he says, I of all people, I who contain Torah, I slept in this place, Aaron and Norah, right? My Norah makom hazeh, right? So on that concept of Yaakov being the place, he founds the place of the Beis HaMikdash, being that he carries Torah. He's the one who carries Torah. By the way, that's why he's eternal. Yaakov lo meis. Yaakov never dies. What's it going to say? Af ma zaro b'chaim, af hu b'chaim. Just as his seed, his children always live. So he always alive. Yaakov never dies. The reason he never dies is because he is Torah's chaim. He holds the life of Torah within him. And therefore, that person who holds the eternity of Torah within him, he lies down and he sleeps in a place that turns out to be his Aron becomes the place of Norah. That's what it is, right? Back to back, as it were, with the Beis HaMikdash. So there on that, the Gemara says, what happens is that this place that is called Norah is one of the descriptions of Hashem's name. Hekel HaGadol HaGibor VaHaNorah. Hashem is Gadol Gibor Norah. Gadol Chesed, Avram. Gibor Din. Norah Yaakov Torah. That's what Hashem is. So the Anshei Knesset. So what happened was that the greats of history, right? The greats of history, when the temple was destroyed, they dropped the word Norah. They said that we describe Hashem. We say Hakel HaGadol HaGibor VaHaNorah. When the temple was destroyed, the Jewish people stopped saying the word Norah. Why? Because Norah is Aron. Norah means Hashem is in the world with Torah. When Hashem is banished from the world, you can't say it. The rule is, you're never allowed to praise Hashem with a quality that doesn't exist in the world at the time. It's a lie. It's not emes. You can only praise Hashem with a quality. That's why if you say HaMelech HaKadosh, for example, during the year, you have to say it again. You can't do that. He's HaMelech HaKadosh at Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. That's when it's appropriate. If you say the inappropriate praise, meaning a praise that is not manifesting itself now, it's invalid. Right? It's not. In the world, you speak out truth. Truth means you say the thing the way it is in the world. If Hashem's not revealing that quality and you saying it, it's not right. And therefore, we can't say Norah anymore. Listen, amazing thing. We can no longer say Norah. We say Akel HaGadol VaGibor. We can no longer say Norah because the temple's destroyed. He's not here. So come along and Sheikh Knesset HaGdolah. And they said, we're going to say Norah again. Why? Listen to what they said. Goyim, non-Jews, Mekalkarin Bahechaloi, Eifoy Noro Otav. Where is his Norah? Goyim are crowing, cackling, rejoicing in the temple. They've destroyed the temple. They're rejoicing in the temple. Where's Hashem's Norah? Norah means like this. You have to understand, the temple is a place that if you go in there inappropriately, you die. If the Kohen Gadol is not fitting, he goes into the place of Norah in the Holy of Holies, he dies. He had a rope attached to his ankle. Every Yom Kippur when he went in, he had a rope attached to his ankle. You know that? The Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, he went in with a rope attached to his ankle. So if he died, they could pull him out because nobody can go in there. If he wasn't spiritually perfect, he died. That's called Norah. Not here the goyim are going in there and they're not dying. So where's Norah? You can't say that. Norah means Hashem is so awesome that if you go into his presence and you're not fitting, you're wiped out. Now there's goyim, evil people, terrible, terrible, immoral people, and they're dancing in the Beis HaMikdash. So he's not Norah anymore. So it's dishonest. You can't say it. So came along the men of the great assembly who, what does the Gemara say? They replaced the crown on the head. They put the crown back to the way it used to be. And they said, we're going to say Norah again. Why? That is his middle of Norah, that he holds himself back. That they can dance around in his temple and he doesn't respond. He holds himself back. He remains silent. That's called Norah. Very weird thing. And so now the Jewish people, after that phase of history, throughout all the centuries, we say, Akel HaGadol HaGibor VaNorah. We say it now, right? What does that mean? The meaning is that this quality of Norah, here's the key, was banished from the Beis HaMikdash, destroyed and left. It's now gone to another place. Where's that place? Us. That's called Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's called the oral law. What happened was there was a written law. The written law was the prophet speaking, Hashem being manifest in the world. and miracles happening all the time, Nora in the Beis HaMikdash, all that was happening. When the temple was destroyed and all that was vanished and all that left, you know what it means that he took out his anger on wood and stones? It means that instead of burning us, the burning took place on the wood. Meaning that the Shekhinah now is no longer being destroyed in the Beis HaMikdash, that's being destroyed, but we are not. We remain alive. It means that the Shekhinah is now in the hearts and minds of the Jewish people. How? Before it used to be in the world in a place called the Written Law, where the prophets came and revealed it, the first four books of Torah. Now it's vested in what this last book of Torah, the book of Devarim, is the root of the oral law. Why? It's the written law. It's Hashem's words. But it's originated by Moshe Rabbeinu. What's the oral law? Where the sages of the Jewish people originate Torah themselves. If you ask the question, where in Torah is the root of the oral tradition? Where in the written law is the seed of the oral law? Sefer Devarim. The book of Devarim. The words that Moshe speaks and Hashem agrees. But they start from us. That's the place in Torah that gave rise to an oral tradition that later the Jewish people can make up Torah of their own. Therefore, the quality, the things like this. First, there's Nora in the Beis HaMikdash. They destroy it. And Sheikh Nesser Sagdola, who oversaw the transition from the written law to the oral law, they replaced the crown on the head. Instead of the crown being in the Beis HaMikdash, the crown is now on the Jewish people. The sages of the Jewish people are able to manifest the fact that we become the Aron again. Of course, there's a massive condition. The condition is you have to be an Aron. If you're going to be just a regular nobody, then there's no Torah in the world. We say, Malka v'sareha b'goyim ein Torah. There's no Torah in the world. So you can't look to the Beis HaMikdash anymore. That's not here. There's no prophecy. There's no miracles. Where do you look now? To the Torah, to the oral law. So those who labor in it and struggle to understand it, now those who make it theirs, who struggle to understand Torah Shebaal Peh, the sages of the Jewish people in their hearts and minds, is a recreation of the Torah, right? It's not the Torah that was given before in thunder, lightning, and manifest with miracles. It's the Torah of our own intuition, right, that we are now able to fathom. And therefore, the message is, the destruction of Tisha B'Av is that the oral, the written Torah gets destroyed and Hashem is banished from the world. The happiness of Tisha B'Av, the fact that we can sit on chairs and start talking about the future, is because only the building was burnt. Meaning that instead of us being destroyed, the Norah transitions, right? The Norah that takes place at that time transitions from the place of the temple into the hearts of the Jewish people. There's a mourning because you've lost the written law. You've lost all that. The rejoicing is that now it's replaced, right, within the context. And therefore, Jeremiah could not say the verses of Tanchumi. He's from the prophecy generation, where his job in the world is to express Hashem speaking in the world. And therefore, Katzavta Aleinu Admo, you Hashem, you're massively angry with us. There's no way to understand. It's a dead end. He's the end of that generation. But we, small as we are, we can add a verse at the end of that. We can see more than he can. If you want an echo of this, if you are sensitive here, this is like Moshe Rabbeinu who comes on the scene, Moshe, and he speaks to Hashem, right? And Hashem takes him through the generations, and he shows him a man called Rabbi Akiva. Amazing, amazing thing. Hashem takes Moshe, and he shows him all the future generations, and he sees Rabbi Akiva, and he says, this is an unbelievable individual. And he listens to Moshe Rabbeinu, listens to Rabbi Akiva in the future, giving a shir, and he cannot understand it. He can't understand the shir. The Torah is something that he, Moshe Rabbeinu, the giver of the Torah, cannot understand the Torah of Rabbi Akiva. So he says to Hashem, you've got a person like this in the world whose Torah is so deep, I cannot even understand it. Give the Torah through him. And he almost lost his mind. I'm supposed to be giving him the Torah. Here's a person hundreds of years later, way below my level, and I cannot understand what he's saying. And then he heard Rabbi Kiva say, they asked him a question, and he said, Saloch ala Moshe v'Sinai. Rabbi Kiva said, this comes to us from Sinai, from Moshe. And then, what's going on? The meaning is, Moshe Rabbeinu cannot understand the Torah of Rabbi Akiva. You know why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah is the Torah Shebik Sav. It's the written Torah. It's all clear. There's nothing. Doesn't you have to figure it out yourself? He listens to a human being fathoming Torah from his own intuition. What does that mean? The whole Torah was open to him. It was all given completely. You have to fathom an opinion of your own and reconstruct Torah. It's like, it doesn't make any sense to you. Jeremiah cannot understand. You understand? Jeremiah, the prophets, they're dealing with a completely different. They're dealing with the Torah of the higher worlds where Hashem is open. It's all dancing. But we function in a new kind of Torah. By the way, Rabbi Akiva is the letters Yaakov, in case you missed it. Akiva is Yaakov. I mean, it's Yaakov means the one who holds the heel, the Akev. Yaakov. Yado Chesed Akev Esav. He's holding onto the heel. The heel means the. Yaakov is to put the Yud into the Akev. Yaakov. To take the Yud and put it all the way down into the heel. That's Torah Shebaal Peh. You can bring it out of the depths, right? Of the heel is a place that's dead, has no life. And therefore, Tisha B'Av, on the one hand, Tisha B'Av is the festival of celebration, of destruction of the Torah. Malka v'sareha, Malka v'sareha, the quality of Malchus, and the leaders, Bagoyim, ain't Torah, there's no Torah. And that's the destruction of Tisha B'Av, it's a mourning. But the reason that the sadness is alleviated on the afternoon of Tisha B'Av is because when the building starts to burn, it becomes apparent that this is not where Norah is in. Now transitions right into this amazing quality of the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is the work of, right? Of course, Ramashi said this on Thursday night, Rav Shapiro said this on Thursday night, which is the eve of reading Sefer Dvarim. So it all comes together. You're moving towards Tisha B'Av. This is the message. We're about to start reading the book of Dvarim. Dvarim is the book that is not separated from the rest of the Torah. Dvarim is the book that you might have thought is completely separate. Completely separate. Nothing to do with the rest of the Torah. There's not even a gap between it. The others all have gaps between them, right? Bereishis, Shemos, a gap. That forms what's called a get, a mechanism of separation. It comes to Sefer Dvarim. This book attaches us. This book of Dvarim attaches us. This is the receiver receiving it and having it within himself. This is where you make the connection. Otherwise, you read that Gemara, it sounds like a get has 12 lines. You know why? Because the gaps between the Sefer Torah have 12 lines. Ah, they happen to be 16. Well, we'll ignore one. We'll just take four. I mean, even a child, that's like fitting it in with a crowbar. So now you don't count the last one. But Chazal never use a crowbar to fit things in, right? It's brain surgery. So Sefer Dvarim is not a separation. The other books are separate, each one in some way. You get to Sefer Dvarim, this is where you reconnect. This is where you absorb it yourself and you go back and you connect with the giver. How do you do it? Because you say it of yourself, right? That's the good news. The hard news is you have to say it yourself now. The good news. In those generations, people had to be tremendously holy to hear Hashem speaking. Nowadays, you have to be tremendously deep to fathom it from yourself, of course. Today, it takes a back-breaking labor of a lifetime spent in Torah Shebaal Peh, right? It's not for free. But that is the potential, and that is the depth of the Arizal's question, is that in the afternoon, which is a bad time, you know what the afternoon means? The afternoon goes towards the evening, and then the sun goes down. You know what the quality of the night is? The quality of the day is that you're connected to the world. The quality of the night is you're completely on your own. Completely on your own. In the night time, I don't mean today. Today there's no night. Today people are so terrified of the night, they're going to put lights everywhere. Today in the modern world, they're going to make them... They're terrified. People are telling them they can't have darkness, so they're going to put lights everywhere. But if you've ever spent a night in the night, for example, you've ever been in the African bush at night. I have a friend who's a game ranger. One night he got lost in the bush. He's a professional game ranger. He spent one night in the bush under a tree, right? Actually in a tree because he was afraid the leopards would get him. Leopards climb trees, but at least the buffalo wouldn't get him. So you're talking about, he told me that he spent the night in a tree and there's just nothing like that. The stars, if there's no moon, by the way, the stars don't give any light. You see the stars, but the Gemara says that. The moon gives light on the earth. Stars don't light. On a starry night, if there's no moon, you can't see anything. You can see the stars, but you can't see it in front of your face. You spend a night like that in the bush, right? Apart from the fear of the lions and the buffalo and the elephant and the black mambas and the pythons and all that stuff, that's enough to. But the point is that it's just the fact that you're completely on your own. There's no connection to the world. That's why people are afraid at night. Little children, adults, some people can pretend they're not, but everybody's afraid of the night. Because the fear of the night is that in real nighttime, right, when there's no... If you're in the night, which is so thick that you can't see anything, not the end of your nose, you're left only with your own awareness. And there's nothing to verify it. There's no point of contact with the world. You're completely alone. The only world that exists then is the world that you construct within yourself, and it's terrifying. Terrifies, complete disconnect from the external world, right? And therefore, as the sun sets, by the way, you see that in the underworld, in the cities of the world, that's when the evil forces really start having a party, right? The evil forces, and just before midnight is where there's a climax. Always, right? That's the real bad stuff. One reason is because the dark forces are, that's when they're ready. The other reason is because that's the time that is so terrifying that they have to... After midnight, the wind goes out of the sails. You know, there's a few fanatics who party till 5 in the morning, but the spirit's gone out of it. You know, you can push them over with a beer can.
question, because we daven Mincha in the afternoon,
yeah.
And we say it's actually a good time to daven because Hashem is favorable to us.
Mincha. Mincha is a tikkun for the bad time. Shacharis, you're riding the wave of the day that begins. That's an amazing thing. Mincha, the right time to daven Mincha is as the sun goes down. It's a tikkun for that time. Absolutely. You're making a tikkun of that time. By the way, Ma'ariv, the evening prayer used to be voluntary. You know what? Amazing. You know that there were only two prayers that were obligatory, Shacharit and Mincha, just like the two sacrifices in the temple. Arvit was something that was completely... Today we have a custom that we've taken it on and it's become an obligation. But Ma'ariv, which was said at night time, was completely voluntary. What's the reason? So people think there were two obligations, like the Korban Mincha and the Korban Shacharit, Tamid. And then at night time, so the whole point of Ma'ariv is that it has to come from you. It's not that they never... The reason that Ma'ariv was not obligatory is because the nighttime is always only you. The nighttime is always you. It has to come from within you. There's no mitzvahs at night. There's no mitzvahs at night. Which mitzvahs are there at night? Shema is to be said as you lie down. The only mitzvah at night ever is Pesach. Because Asher lo yom velo laila. The whole point of the first night of Pesach is that it's not a nighttime. Asher lo yom velo laila. It's not a nighttime. Asher... The first night of Pesach has the din of being a daytime. We say Hallel. It's not a nighttime at all. But night as night, what mitzvahs are there at night? And therefore, the reason that Ma'ariv was optional was not because they, you know, never happened to. The point about Arvit is that it dwells up from within you. It's a connection to Hashem in the darkness. Torah Shebaal Peh. It's what you create of yourself, right? Galut is darkness at nighttime. We're now way in the darkness. So now the mode of Torah in this era is the mode of darkness, and therefore it's what you create. The consciousness that you have at nighttime when you're stuck in a tree, right in the Kruger National Park, and the only sounds you can hear are the lions roaring 10 feet below you. Yeah, interesting experience. You all tried once. Good for your emunah. Right? That is a very amazing experience, and that is the... That is the feeling of the receiver being on his own, detached. That is called Nora, the Aron. The Aron that is now the place where Torah is no longer in the Beis HaMikdash. It is now in the Neshama, which is the same letters as Mishnah. But yeah, okay, can we read a couple of lines? You didn't get very far today. But anyway, that's what he means by the cycle of time. Each time phase in the world is having its own...
Sorry, one thing.
Yeah.
So, did this also happen in between the destruction of the two temples? Was it the temple when the first temple destroyed?
Yes, yes.
It should have been a transference then.
Yes, it began then. When the first temple was destroyed, right? By the Babylonians. That is, strictly speaking, when the exile into Babel took place. That is when the generation of prophecy, that was the beginning. That's the beginning, because when they went into Babylonian exile, that was the time when, that was more or less the time when prophecy ended, right? The destruction of the first temple was very close to the time when prophecy ended. By the time the second temple was built, there were no prophets at all. Who built the second temple? Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra was one of the very last. Ezra was Malachi. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Malachi was the last of the prophets. So Ezra was Malachi. So he was the one who finished prophecy and built the second temple. What was the characteristic of the second temple? No Shekhinah, right? You know, it's an amazing thing. The Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, they were the ones who were... They were the people who built the temple. They built the second temple. Among them was Ezra, Mordechai. And they were the ones who made our prayers. They made up Haim Tiknu, Kedushas, Tfilas, Kedushas, Tfilas, Brachas, and Avdolas. They're the ones who made up the Tfilas we have. While they were rebuilding Jerusalem, they were rebuilding Yerushalayim. They were living in Yerushalayim, building the Beis HaMikdash. They made up the Amidah that we have today. Hashiveinu, the Boinei Yerushalayim. The Amidah we have today is an Amidah of Galut. Please, Hashem, come back to Yerushalayim, build the... They were building it. The answer is, it was empty. It was empty. When they lived in the second bais, when the Jews lived in Israel, with the temple, it was empty. Of course, it was empty. There was no Shekhinah there. Therefore, we call it like living in Israel today. It's called Galut. I'm not knocking it. You should live there. It's wonderful. It's amazing. But it's not, you know, in case you haven't noticed, it's not like a rebuilt place, something that's with Hashem present. It's, you know, situation of Golus, right? Greece. Hanukkah took place in Israel. And it's called the fourth exile. Exile doesn't have to be living in another place. Exile can be living in Yerushalayim. Right? But it was a place of, and therefore it began with the destruction of the first temple, and it ended with destruction of the second. That's when this fading of the light took place. Prophecy began to fade when the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and by the time the second was built, there was nothing left. That is when the phase of the Mishnah began. Shimon HaTzadik, he was the last Kohen Gadol. He worked in the Beis HaMikdash. He saw the miracle of the Western light occasionally happening. He met Alexander, the Greek era, darkness, and that's when it all ended. That exactly was the transition. And this was the men of the Great Assembly that oversaw the transition from one phase to another. Let's just finish the paragraph.
I just wanted to ask, I thought the status of the Beis HaMikdash corresponded with where we were holding internally.
Yeah.
So if we were empty internally, then the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed.
It was empty. We were empty and it was empty.
So then how come when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, it's transferred into us? Because the whole reason it was destroyed is because we were empty.
It's transferred to us in a new way. You have to understand this. The Torah is now transferred to us in a way, not prophecy like it was before. Not Hashem speaking to us. We now speak into Him. What happens now is it's transferred into us in a new mode called Torah Shebaal Peh, where our opinions become Torah. It's a whole new kind of Torah, right? That's the sadness of the fact that we lost the original Torah, and that's our greatness, is we can do it ourselves now. Okay, it's a deep subject. There's much more to say about it, but I'm actually writing a book about it now, about all the things that changed from before to after. Prophecy, miracles, brachos, blessings came into being, all the changes that happened, dozens of things that happened to us that redefine who we are in that transition from prophecy to non-prophecy. That's what Tisha B'Av, that's one of the things of Tisha B'Av, is that transition. Let's just read the paragraph, because we're not meeting for a few weeks now. Amar HaSeichel, I have to explain this to you. We see that their times have different, not that things happened at certain times and that made the time special. The times were special. And that's why those things happened then, right? V'hu ma she'ama koheles, l'kol zman v'es l'kol chayfetz. That's the depth of what it means in Kohelet, which in English is called Ecclesiastes, if that helps you. Where it says, l'kol zman v'et l'kol chayfetz. There's a time for everything and every desire in the world. Not that there are things in the world and then we mark the time. But l'kol zman, the word zman in Hebrew means mezuman. It means ready. Mezuman, right? In Hebrew, the word zman. Eight is a different thing. Eight means a time. Zman means a time ready for something to happen. It's muzman, right? Hazmana means an invitation for something to happen. So the word zman in Hebrew doesn't mean a time on the calendar. Zman means a potential energy that could make something happen, right? That's why it's called a zman. In Hebrew, today, cash is called mezuman. It means ready to do something with. It's ready, to, right? That's it. It's a deep source. In Torah, money is called ma'od, ma'odecha, b'chol ma'odecha. Ma'od means something that's supposed to become more. Ma'od means more. Right? People are supposed to be ma'od. Ma'od is the same letters as Adam. Anyway, that wasn't what they're thinking. That wasn't what the modern, you know. Anyway, but anyway. V'hu ma she'amar koheles, yeah. V'haloi gam laze tzarech she'yesheresh hagun vaday. And of course, if time has this reality, then there must be a source for it, obviously, in the world. And that is what we're going to discuss next. And that's it for today.